Hi, everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to another episode of It's All About Food. Thanks for joining me. I want to bring on my guest, Ramin Ganeshram, who is a journalist and chef and the author of a number of cookbooks, as well as The General's Cook, which came out in 2018. It's a novel. But today we're going to be talking about one of the Edible series books. I'm just in love with the Edible series. Today we're talking about Saffron, A Global History. Welcome, Ramin.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
So how is it that you are the one who got to write the story about saffron for the Edible series?
It's a great question. I am a long colleague with Andrew Smith, who is sort of, you know, the editor and has oversight of the series. And we've talked about it a bit over the years, the series at large. And, you know, it just occurred to me one day that there wasn't one on saffron. And it's kind of funny that it occurred to me because it's such a daily part of my life and my cooking because of my cultural background that I really thought, oh no, surely they did one on saffron. Of course they did. And when I saw that there wasn't, I said, hey, what about this? And he agreed that it was a white space that should be filled.
The thing about saffron, especially here in the United States, okay, we look at ourselves as a melting pot. We have all these different cultures. People bring all different kinds of cuisines. And when it comes to saffron, I know the people that I talk to that know about it say, it's so expensive.
Yeah.
So let's just start with that. Why is saffron so expensive? And is it really that expensive?
So the thing about saffron is it is really that expensive, and it's always been that expensive, even in antiquity, from its first wild harvest or cultivation. It has almost always been gram for gram equal to the price of gold. And there's a reason for it. And the reason is that it's laborious. It takes a lot of hand labor to harvest saffron. It's a little bit of a finicky plant. So it only grows in very certain climates. But you quite literally have to pull the tiny, tiny thread of the saffron out of the flower. It's a crocus that looks pretty much almost exactly like the spring crocus, the purple crocus we see every spring. Not the same plant, but it looks very similar. Saffron's an autumn crocus. It takes a lot of physical hand labor. And the last thing about saffron is that you have to have an enormous, enormous amount of saffron to produce the smallest amount of the spice.
And we haven't figured out any way to automate this harvesting process.
No, and the reason for that is that it's such a delicate plant that it would be very difficult to create a mechanization, but if the flowers get bruised, and they get bruised quite easily, you essentially ruin the product. So it's not really something that could be automated.
Hmm. In some ways, I like that.
Yeah.
It makes it special, right?
It does. I mean, it really is something that when you have your saffron that you have purchased, you are really purchasing something that somebody with a great deal of dedication, first as a farmer, and in the harvest and the production, has really committed to this plant. It is low yield, high labor. The returns can be great, but they're not guaranteed. So you really have people who are passionate creating the saffron that you're then using in your cooking.
And what do you love about saffron? Other than it's from, well, you're familiar with it as a family cuisine.
Yeah. I mean, I think what I love about it is that it's incredibly versatile. You know, it's not just the color. It does have a very specific taste that it cannot be mimicked. You know, you really cannot substitute anything for saffron. The color, of course, is beautiful if it's used the right way. The aroma is amazing. I think, you know, I just love the fact that the smallest amount of saffron can elevate pretty much anything you want to use it for, even if it's just a simple tea. Adding a few threads of saffron to a tea, that tea somehow becomes magical. and different from your everyday brew.
I was trying to do the math about what saffron really costs, and it can vary. Mm-hmm. So I was trying to figure out on a thread basis what saffron costs. And I wasn't really successful because I was going from grams to ounces, and there are so many different varieties. Do you have and it depends. There's a wide range of cost based on quality. Do you have a feeling for what an individual thread can cost?
You know, I have to tell you, that's a brilliant question that no one has ever asked me. And I don't. And the reason is actually, I think what a lot of people don't realize is that different grades of saffron have different weights and different thicknesses. So it's almost impossible to say, because one variety is not going to weigh the same in the individual thread. So, but a gram is a gram is a gram, no matter how much it takes individually to make up that gram.
So gram-wise, I was just looking on Amazon for costs, and I saw a big range. And you talk about different grades, and we don't have to go into that here because I think if people are really interested in the different ranges of qualities in saffron, you could get the book and have it there as a reference. But there are many different types and ranges and qualities. But there was this one A-plus grade, highest grade saffron for tea, paella, rice, desserts, and it's $12.99 for 2 grams. Mm-hmm. And then I saw another that was like $184 for the same amount. And I'm sure they can go higher than that. So there's a big range in price.
Yeah, there's a big range in price. And I think, so here's what I'll tell you generally. If it feels like really inexpensive, like a great deal, and it's too good to be true, it probably is too good to be true. And the reason is that saffron, there's a lot of counterfeiting still of saffron. There's a lot of other food fillers that can be used to bulk up saffron. It's not really completely locked down in terms of quality control. So that's really probably the reason, you know. So what people should do is really get familiar with the different grades and the different growing areas, which is, as you said, all in the book. And then once you get, you know, really familiar with that, you'll understand that this is what you're actually purchasing versus something that feels like saffron and it isn't. And I should say that in some parts of the world, interestingly enough, turmeric is incorrectly labeled as saffron, not because they're trying to pass it off as saffron, because of culture. It's just a cultural misnomer in certain areas.
Okay. They're both great spices.
Wonderful. Yeah, absolutely.
And like turmeric or turmeric, you say turmeric, I say turmeric. I'm not sure if they're both okay, but I've heard them pronounced both ways. So. they both have medicinal properties. And what is saffron supposed to be good for? Or are we still trying to figure that out?
No, actually, so here's the interesting thing about saffron. From antiquity, from at least 3,000 years ago, first through sort of oral history, and then from early doctors and pharmacists, there's been this long, long list of things that saffron is good for, mostly anti-inflammatory, but as well, you know, good for mood and depression, good for the lungs. It's particularly indicated in diseases of the eye. I mean, the list is so long, it is almost ludicrous. But here's the interesting thing. Modern scientists, particularly in saffron growing regions like Iran, are now going back and looking at the properties of saffron, particularly saffronol, which is that main property that gives it the smell. And a lot of these things are proving true. It is a powerful anti-inflammatory. It apparently does have positive indication in treating depression and scientifically based. So saffron is fascinating to me because it is one of those few spices or herbs where almost mark for mark, the oral histories of its use medicinally have been proven true.
Wow. I always wonder how we started eating different foods.
Yeah.
Do you have any idea how we got interested in pulling out these little threads in a flower and said, oh, I want to dye my clothes with it. I want to eat this.
I don't think anybody knows. What we know is that saffron was first a wild plant in the Mediterranean, particularly in Greece. Cave paintings in Greece indicate that it was used for religious purposes. All I can say is that if by chance someone even happened to touch the stigma, the thread that is the saffron from the crocus, it will come off on your fingers. Your fingers will be immediately stained, deep orange and red. And I have to think at that point, somebody must have thought, oh, you know, what could I do with this? You know?
And then sniff your fingers and say, oh. And
that, exactly.
Right.
Exactly. Or what is this? Sniff, taste, you know, and realize, oh, this isn't that bad. Because it is a strange thing. It's a very delicate thing. You know, it doesn't really feel like it could be happenstance, but, and the other thing is, like with many things, I would suspect it has to do with observing animals, you know, interact with it.
Are there animals that like to eat saffron or at least the flower?
I do know that in the Middle East, in places like Iran, I should say, not the Middle East, doesn't really grow across the Middle East, but Iran and in Kashmir and India, once they've taken the stigma out, they do feed the flower to livestock. Mm. So clearly they'll eat it.
Is the flower edible for us?
You know, I don't know.
Yeah, that's that might be fun. Know. Just like we eat zucchini flowers and other flowers, who knows? That could be a whole nother side industry.
It's true. I know, it's true. It's very delicate. It's so filled with water that so saffron has to be picked first thing in the morning at dawn, like right when the dew is just about dried up. It's so specific. If it's too early, it's too water laden. If it's too late, it's beginning to dry out. So the process has to be very fast of pulling out these stigmas. And almost by the time you're done, the flower is crushed. So it's interesting. Yeah. But that's a great question. Yeah.
So you talk about throughout history, since it's so labor intensive, that very often women and children were used to do the harvesting. And I imagine that they weren't paid very much. And I imagine that even to this day, in a lot of places, they're not paid very much.
True. Yeah.
Which, what do we do with that? But you do mention that there is one company that is doing some good things. Can you talk about Rumi Spice and how they got started and what they're doing with saffron?
Yeah, so from what I understand about this company, it was started by the company founders actually had been soldiers, American soldiers stationed in Afghanistan, and really saw the devastation in that country. I personally am not sure why they had an affinity for saffron, but what they did know was that it could be potentially that this climate might be suitable. Being located at where it is, right? Saffron's grown in Iran, border to Afghanistan, is grown in, you know, the northern part of India, which includes what is Pakistan, you know, and so they had this idea that what they could do is encourage farmers to grow saffron instead of opium. Opium being a very valuable crop, though illegal and part of a sort of problematic trade and industry, but saffron being equally as valuable. And they've had amazing success working with cooperatives of farmers, paying people, you know, a really decent living wage. Working with families. So they're doing amazing work. And, you know, one thing I will say, it is quite problematic in many places where saffron is, the labor is performed by women and children. But I do want to point out that also in many of these cases, these are family collectives. You know, it's not necessarily that, you know, impoverished women and children are pressed into this labor, although that does happen in parts of the world to harvest saffron. But in many places, they are family collectives and it is a family industry. So it's kind of everybody participating, not unlike the way here in the United States in the 18th and 19th century, whole families participated in the agriculture of their family farm, which sustained them.
Did you mention somewhere in the book that monkeys could also be used to harvest?
I think what you're thinking about is that the cave paintings in Thera in Greece that depict that earliest harvest have women and monkeys. We don't know that that was really depicting reality or if it was depicting sort of an idealized world of saffron harvest for the purpose of religious festivals.
Exactly. That's where I got it. Yeah. And right away I thought about, which I think you're aware of, the monkeys that are trained and exploited to harvest coconuts in Thailand.
Very much so. Yeah.
And I was thinking when I was reading it, oh, don't put this idea into anybody's head. We don't need to train monkeys to harvest saffron.
No.
So, okay. Can we just review a little? Doesn't have to be too scientific, but there are two words that you use a lot in the book describing the parts of this plant, the saffron plant. And there's the corm and the stigma. Mm-hmm. Can we get an understanding of the corm and the stigma and how they're involved in saffron harvesting and growing?
Sure. Absolutely. So the corm is, the best way to think about it is the portion underground, what we might consider the base of the root system. It's not a root the way, let's say, a plant like a zucchini would have, right? Mm-hmm. It's not that type of root system. It's closer to a rhizome, but it is not a rhizome. So some rhizomes that we understand really well are like ginger, right? It's an underground root. A lot of flowering bulbs have rhizomes where they send out these kind of knotty, thick root systems. And from that, more flowers are produced. For the saffron crocus, it's called a corm. It looks almost like a tiny little onion in many ways. And that is how the plant feeds itself and grows and then creates further clusters off of one corm for more saffron to grow. So it reproduces the way a lot of bulb plants reproduce under the ground, right? Mm-hmm. They multiply under the ground. The stigma is within the flower. When you look at the flower, and again, I encourage people to look at a spring crocus in the spring to understand what it looks like, even though it's not the same plant. That little red thread that comes right out of the middle of the plant is the stigma. And it has, you know, it has this role in pollinization, right? This is the, when a bee lands on it or a fly, lands on it, this is where, like, the pollen and so on is retained. Interestingly enough, though, saffron does not reproduce in that way. As I said, it reproduces by a corm under the ground. It's considered an asexual plant. So it is not necessarily, it's a fascinating thing because it functions in the same way. It's big, it's a sexual organ. But, you know, it's not quite the same pollinization process as we think of.
So if we want to transport the plant to grow it somewhere else, we don't carry seeds. We carry these corms carefully.
Right.
Carefully. Carefully. And you've talked about the history and how this plant was protected in many places because of its value, and you could lose your life if you took a corm and brought it somewhere else.
Yeah. Yes. In fact, throughout the Crusades, there were laws that anyone who took a saffron corm out of a growing area would be punished by death. And all the way into Europe, you know, there were climates where saffron was grown in Europe. There's a legend that a town in England called Saffron Walden, very big producer of saffron, in the Middle Ages, and for actually quite a few hundred years. They're trying to regrow it now. The legend is that a crusader put the quorum in his staff when he left the Middle East from the Crusades, and brought it back and grew it. But the penalties around the world for stealing saffron, a quorum, were often death, sometimes torture. It was
interesting times.
Yeah.
Yeah. A lot of horrible things happened during the Crusades in the name of, I'm not going to go there.
Yeah, that's true.
I always like to comment on the human species and how unpleasant we can be from time to time, still to this day.
And I think the thing about this is that, you know, you make a point that I think is really important point to make, which is this. People think about it, that's crazy. Why would there be death penalties about stealing a spice? Why would there be, you know, torture about just stealing a food product? And let's go back to the thing that we said in the beginning. It is worth its weight in gold. It was understood to be a source of great wealth. It would be the equivalent of stealing the king's gold or a nation's, you know, most valuable possession for those nations that produce saffron. So, you know, it's not just simply you stole this spice or this culinary ingredient. Insane that you should be, you know, have that level of punishment. But it's not really about that.
It's about money. Yeah. And yet saffron has made its way all around the world because of profit and because of taste and because of custom. Lots of reasons.
Correct.
Yeah. Correct. You mentioned all the different places that we have saffron now. And I enjoyed reading about the Jain festival, the Goma Teshwara festival, where they make a saffron milk and pour it over this giant statue. And I was reading between the lines there because you were commenting about this religious group and how they, I don't think they like to waste or to live luxuriously. And so this is something of great value that they're pouring over statue, which must have a lot of meaning for them.
Right, exactly. And, you know, it's a festival that is only held every 12 years in India. It's been held since 981 BC, before current era. So if you think about that, think about the long history of it. Not only was saffron valuable now and expensive now, and you know it's as you said, it's important in a sect of if I remember correctly, the Jain religion, which is a very ascetic sort of religion. But think about it in 981, you know, that's not a long time ago, you know, to be kind of not just the saffron, frankly, the milk too.
The milk.
Like, this is So, but it just shows you how revered it was, that it should be used for this purpose of revering a religious figure.
Whew. Okay, now let's talk about saffron in food and food. I want to let you know that I'm a longtime vegan, and I use saffron in all kinds of vegan foods. Certainly paella can be made vegan. I was looking at your recipes and you mentioned using bamba rice. Do you know the difference or have experienced the difference between bamba and arborio rice? Because we frequently see arborio rice in recipes for paella.
Yeah, so bamba rice is actually grown in a controlled region in Spain. And irony, it's not unlike saffron in that it's got its own, like, you know, designated region, right? And it is the traditional rice for paella. Arborio is, it works, it certainly works, but it is more readily available. It's I'm trying to recall it. I think that Arborio, one or the other of them needs more liquid.
I think the Bonfire Rice needs more liquid. Yeah.
Yeah.
I was just reading about it. So.
Yeah. But I mean, that is the traditional. It's more difficult to get, to your point, although one can get anything online. But, you know, and I tend to think that that's why Arborio is more common, because it's just easier to get outside of Spain.
But it's not the same consistency. Yeah.
Not the same consistency.
Okay. And you like Bomba.
I like Bomba. You know, I tend to like I like the authentic thing, the real thing, sure, when it comes to traditional recipes. That's not to say that, you know, adaptations, people shouldn't feel free to make their adaptations. But I feel like if you're gonna present something, present it in the method that it's supposed to be presented, and then let people do what they want. But,
well, it's funny. Yeah. We buy a lot of food nowadays during COVID that we can have delivered. And I recently discovered a place in Brooklyn called Food to Live, foodtolive.com, where we can buy a lot of organic grains and beans and dried fruit. It's really expensive by the pound, but it's very, very reasonable when you buy in bulk. So I'm buying like 10 pounds of this and 8 pounds of this and whatever. So I just bought, 8 pounds of organic Arborio rice because I want to make some paella, because I'm in a mood for saffron after reading your book.
That's good to hear.
And then I went back and I realized that Bomba is more authentic. So when I finish this Arborio, a big bag, then I got to look for Bomba. And I don't know if organic Bomba is will probably be even more challenging to find.
Probably. Yeah.
So on the subject of organic, is there organic saffron? I've seen a few online. Is there a difference? Do you know if saffron is grown with pesticides or herbicides or anything like that?
I have to admit to you, that is not something I know. I don't know enough about the modern farming practices. Mm-hmm. It is a wonderful question. And the thing about saffron is that it is such a delicate plant. It is really delicate. I would find it hard to believe that it could withstand a lot of chemical intervention.
I'm
not a horticulturist and I don't know, but interestingly enough, there's an entire saffron institute at, I think it's the University of Vermont, if I remember correctly, in the United States, dedicated to studying this for the purpose of growing saffron in the United States, which it has been done since the 18th century, University of Vermont, North American Center for Saffron, they would know. But to your point, now that we're talking about this, reading that the center's paperwork, I read a lot about hooping for cold climates and different methods of growing. I don't think I've ever read anything about pesticides. Mm-hmm. Again, not a horticulturist, not to say I spent a lot of time on that, but I tend to think not.
I'm feeling not too, but I think I'll reach out to that place in Vermont, see what they have to say. I never thought about it until just now.
Yeah, it's a great question.
What else do we have to cover when it comes to saffron? You can find saffron around the world. You've talked about how it has a specific harvest time and it requires a certain environment, and yet people still find a way to grow it in very different places.
Yeah.
You even mentioned Canada.
Yes. Yeah. Here's what I think. I think that saffron is it has this lore and lure, right? Uh-huh. Of the exotic and being very magical. It's a beautiful plant. That the byproduct of the crocus, the saffron stigma, is beautiful, I think, but it has this lure of a high price. I think a lot of people get into it thinking that, you know, I could get a lot of money for this crop, and they don't realize what a low yield, high labor crop it is. And it really, you know, you think you're going to come away with this fortune at the end of your harvest, and you probably aren't. You're going to be disappointed to see how many hundreds of flowers it takes to create just a gram.
Yeah. you wrote to make 1 kilogram, which is 1,000 grams, you mm-hmm. need somewhere between 70,000 and 200,000 flowers.
Yeah.
It's a lot of flowers.
It is a lot of flowers.
It's a lot of flowers.
So you see, yeah.
So one more question. How much saffron do you use a year? Do you have any idea? Because a little goes a long way, so you don't need a lot.
No. I don't know. I mean, it is more than most people. I use it probably every other day. Mm. And I'll tell you, I'm lucky in that my mother's family is Iranian. I'm half Iranian. And so when people come and go, they bring it.
Right.
So I say that to you to say that I don't really keep track of it. I think if I had to pay for it, if I had to actually buy saffron of the quality that I'm accustomed to, I would know exactly how much. It's a lot. I mean, it's probably several ounces a year, mm-hmm. Which is quite a bit for saffron, because as you say, a little goes a long way. 2 or 3 threads, which don't weigh even probably a quarter, a tenth of an ounce, is all you need, right? And I probably use several ounces a year easily.
So you prefer saffron from Iran?
I do, because I'm accustomed to it. But if I'm honest with you, I will tell you that, in fact, the most remarkable saffron in the world is produced in Kashmir in India. Mm-hmm. And I've recently been able to get some of that. And it is astonishing how lovely it is, how strong the smell and the color. You know, I obviously have a lot of loyalty and love and comfort around Iranian saffron, but the Kashmiri saffron is just not to be believed. It's so nice.
So is it just stronger, or it's got its unique character?
It's a little bit thicker. The stigma is a little bit thicker, fatter. It is stronger. The scent is really strong. It's so strong that you have no doubt that this is saffron, right?
It's
that's the key. I mean, saffron has a very unique smell of its own. It's almost a little bit antiseptic and a little bit sweet. And when you smell this, you know, this is the real stuff. Like, you don't have to think, is it? I'm not sure. That's true of Iranian saffron too, but Kashmiri saffron, even before it comes out of the package, the sealed package smells like saffron. Mm. It's that powerful. And the color it's a deeper color. It's a beautiful, beautiful product, but expensive and hard to get.
And that's what makes it so special, especially now for many of us. We have access to just about everything. So many different foods from all over the world are affordable. I want to qualify that seemingly affordable, because we're not really paying the true price, and we're not really realizing the implication on those who are growing it and are harvesting it, packaging it, because they may not be treated as well as we like. So there are all different kinds of prices that are involved that are invisible to us. But that said, we have just everything at our disposal. And so food, which should be precious to us because it nourishes us and we can't live without it, should have more value, not monetarily, but just it gives us life. And so many foods we take for granted, but saffron is still something that has that royal special value.
That's right. It's a spice that's worthy of respect. And I think you asked in the beginning, why do I like saffron? And I have to say that listening to you speak really crystallized for me that one of the reasons I really like it is because it is a spice, it's a food worthy of respect, in the way that we should always respect everything we consume because of what goes into it. And if it takes saffron to remind us that that's how we should be thinking about what we consume, then all the more power to that.
I agree. Thank you. I love that. I'm going to let you go in a moment, but I just wanted to mention your book, The General's Cook, which you wrote or was published in 2018. I have not read it, but it looks fascinating.
Thank you.
Can you just give us a little idea of what it's about?
Sure. It was published in 2018. The paperback came out late last year. The Kindle edition actually now has recipes. What it's about is George Washington's enslaved cook, a man by the name of Hercules Posey. He lived in Philadelphia with Washington when that was the nation's capital, in the president's house. And he was famous in his own time. He was well known. I often call him America's first celebrity chef. His story is remarkable because what people don't realize is that George and Martha Washington went to great lengths to ensure the enslaved people that they brought into Philadelphia, which was part of, obviously still is, Pennsylvania, which had gradual abolition and a pathway to freedom. George and Martha went to great lengths to make sure the enslaved people with them could not partake of that freedom. But yet Hercules self-emancipated. He escaped. We did not know what happened to him for 218 years until a colleague of mine and I actually were able to track him down in 2019 and learn the rest of his story. And I will leave you with this. The ending of my book, which is a novel that I say is mostly true, places Hercules in a place doing work completely written as fiction that once we finally tracked him down, turned out to be in fact what he did. Ooh. So it actually turned out to be the truth.
Wow.
So, yeah.
Okay.
Well, so I'd love one day to talk to you more about it. It's my passionate yeah, life's work.
Definitely. Yeah. Okay. Well, let's wrap this up now and maybe we'll have another chat about the General's Cook, because I think especially now.
Yeah.
People want to know the story and need to know this story.
Yeah,
we need to know more of the history of this country.
Yes.
Face it and accept it and rise above it.
Right. Agreed. So thank you. Yes.
Okay. Well, Ramin Ganeshram, thank you so much for joining me today and talking about Saffron, a global history.
Thank you so much. It was such a pleasure to spend this time with you.
Okay. Be well. Stay safe. Take care.
Bye-bye.
And that wraps up another of the edible series, Saffron, a Global History, by Ramin Ganeshram. And it made me very hungry, reading almost every page and wondering what the saffron tasted like and smelled like from all the different regions that were discussed in the book. And then I remembered that here at home, at the Responsible Eating and Living headquarters, we had a little container of saffron. And I said to Gary DiMattei, Gary,
let's buy some arborio rice and make some risotto.
That's exactly what happened. And as I mentioned earlier in the program, the arborio rice arrived organic from Food to Live. And I'm waiting for my risotto.
Well, I just got on the program. What did I miss?
I was talking about saffron.
Oh, and who were you talking about saffron with?
With Ramin Ganeshram, who wrote the little book, Saffron, A Global History. You know how much I love the edible series.
Yeah, you know, that's what brought me into the studio just now. I heard you say edible series, and I thought you said edible series. And I thought, is she talking about the Oedipus complex? Which is a term used by Sigmund Freud in his theory of psychosexual stages of development to describe a child's feelings of desire for his or her opposite sex parent and jealousy and anger toward his or her same sex parent? And apparently no.
Apparently no. I thought I was the one with the hearing problem.
You're talking about the edible, not edible.
Edible. I need to caress my continence a little.
No,
more.
I was just on the other side of the studio door.
Yes.
No, I'm kidding. It's great to be back on It's All About Food with you, Karen Hartglass.
Thank you, and it's always wonderful to be here with you.
Well, I love saffron.
Tell me why.
I'm just wild about saffron.
And saffron's wild about you.
Hey!
I'm just wild about saffron. And she just wild about me. They call it... No, never mind.
Yeah.
Anyway... Yeah, so saffron's great, and risotto is great, and it's going to be made here soon because we bought how many pounds of arborio rice?
I think something like 8.
8 pounds.
That's not a lot. We eat a lot.
Yeah, but that's a lot of rice.
It'll go, especially if I'm going to make you make risotto. I'm thinking of
We can make a lot of things. And I think it's time to make a paella.
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 Yeah. Well, for everybody who doesn't know what a Borio rice is, a Borio rice. What is so special about a Borio rice? It's an Italian short grain rice. It is named after the town of Arborio in the Po Valley, which is situated in the main region of Piedmont in Italy. Arborio is also grown in Arkansas, California, and Missouri.
I wonder where the Arborio rice is that we got, and how is it we're allowed to call it Arborio if it has to be from Arborio?
Right. I think Arkansas, California, and Missouri are wrong to call it
Arborio. They're wrong. That's like in Texas when they grow a version of basmati rice, they call it Tex-Mati.
Tex-Mati.
Because I don't think they can call it basmati. But then we buy a basmati rice from California and it's called basmati. So I'm making myself more and more confused and I'm going to need to look into this.
Well, that's why I'm here, Karen, is to confuse you even further.
But I like the idea that special foods have the name of where they come from.
Right.
That's like Dijon mustard comes from Dijon.
Champagne. You can't call it champagne unless it's from...
Champagne.
Right.
And I think food should be like that.
And they call it champagne all the time, even when it's not from...
Champagne. Yes. The French are really good at that.
There needs to be a term police.
Someone needs to be talking about terroir last week.
Right.
And food tastes different from different regions. So maybe they should have different names.
Absolutely.
I think we should start a petition.
Well, I would imagine that this Arborio rice that you purchased from Food to Live is the real deal. But who knows? Should we call it olive oil if it's not made with olives?
No.
People do.
I know. That's a crime.
Right. They color it a certain way. They give it a certain flavor, but there's not a single olive in the olive oil.
Who knows what's true anymore?
Who does?
Who does? Anyway, we're going to have some delicious risotto made by Gary.
And maybe some paella. But you had an interesting fact about paella that you discussed on the program today.
I discussed it with Ramin that it's made from bamba rice.
Right.
Which I've never tried. I have no idea where I can find it or get it organic.
Yeah.
But I'm not going to worry about it until we finish the Arborio rice.
What is bamba rice? Okay, I'll tell you. Bamba rice is a short grain variety of rice primarily cultivated in the eastern parts of Spain. Ah, that's where you come from, Karen. That's where your people come from.
A piece of my people.
Right. It is commonly used in paella and other dishes in the Valencian cuisine and is often referred to as Valencian rice. It has a short grain due to the presence of amylopectin.
Mm-hmm.
Amylopectin.
Amylopectin. So what I'm getting from this, Gary,
yes,
is that there are many, many varieties of rice.
Yes, and don't forget, last week we talked about forbidden rice.
We did. Shh.
Forbidden. It's forbidden to discuss it. That's how forbidden this rice is.
But there are many varieties of many foods. And as time goes on, we seem to have less options in terms of varieties.
Yes.
And we should, I think, be celebrating all these different varieties somehow.
And we do here on the show. We're actually giving them airtime. Right?
Yes.
We are. And it's great. So bamba rice is another thing I need to try after listening to this program, which I thought was a great program. Who knew that a little book about saffron would be so interesting?
Yes. I really like all of these little books. I just like hearing stories about food.
Edible series, not the Edible series.
Yes, the Edible series.
Edible series.
The books are not meant to be eaten.
Right. No. They're meant to be red.
They're meant to be red.
Or white. Or blue. Or orange. Whatever color their books are.
Red.
They're meant to be red.
R-E. Gary, what's in your risotto and why?
Well, the recipe is at Responsible Eating and Living. And it's also a recipe that has been published in a cookbook.
Yes, the living the farm sanctuary life.
Yes. So if you want to know what's in my risotto, you're going to have to go to Responsible Eating and Living and look up the recipe.
Okay, I'll link it to this program.
Yes. No, seriously, though. It's called Risotto Veganese because it's a riff on Risotto Milanese, which is a traditional dish. Risotto is a traditional dish from Milano. At least that's what we're told in cooking school. And that's what we're told in many cookbooks. And so the Risotto Veganese is our vegan version of the braised rice dish from northern Italy. And it's an adaptation of Risotto Milanese. The distinctive ingredient in both the classic version and our vegan version is a good quality saffron from Spain, if you can believe that. Because Spain has the best saffron, according to people who like saffron, where I come from.
Yes. Now,
I'm sure...
The book talks about
all kinds of different varieties, yes. Which is why my information is biased from the old Italians.
What I learned is that the saffron that's grown in different regions, they're all unique.
Right.
And some have stronger flavors, some have less strong flavors, some have long and thicker stigmas, the threads.
Stigmas, that's an interesting stigma to get over. Arrapunch. But Spanish saffron used to be very expensive. It used to set you back around $20 an ounce in a specialty food store. I'm not sure what you all talked about with respect to price, but it's pretty expensive.
It's expensive. That was the first thing we talked about. But, you know, you talk about Spanish saffron.
Yes.
And sometimes what appears to be Spanish is really from Iran.
Ah,
and
that may or may not
be a bad thing because the Iranian saffron is excellent. But for lots of different reasons, sometimes it's all in the book. You have to read the book.
What goes in my risotto Milanese is something that everybody can do, but it's the process that's a little difficult. So it's just stock, a lot of vegetable stock, 2 cups of the arborio rice, 1/2 cup of white wine, about a teaspoon of saffron thread. So it's expensive, but you're only using about a teaspoon, an onion, and if you want to use some olive oil, you can. The recipe calls for olive oil. So you heat the vegetable stock in a stock pot. You add the saffron to it to infuse it like a tea, right? It's got to infuse. And then you saute the onions and then you saute the rice. And then little by little, and here's the part of the process that takes the time, you add 1 cup at a time of the saffron infused stock until it absorbs. And then you add another cup until it absorbs and you add another cup. And this process is time consuming, but oh so worth it.
Because you get this lovely creamy consistency.
Yes, it's this wonderful, almost like a pudding, like a rice pudding, but a savory rice pudding.
I want to stop for a moment and say that there are some places out there in the world, restaurants before COVID, that would make something that they called risotto. And it was nothing like risotto.
No.
And it wasn't cooked like you said, and it wasn't creamy, and it wasn't pudding-like. No. It was just like some cooked rice with some microwave vegetables stirred in it.
Yeah, in cooking school, we had a chef that called paprika poor person's saffron. So
because it has a red color.
Because it has the red color. It has nothing, it's not even close to the taste. But
yes.
They jokingly said, this is poor person's saffron.
Yeah, in the book, Ramin talked about turmeric being used as a replacement.
Oh, yeah.
But the point was that if you don't have saffron and it calls for saffron in a recipe, it's better to leave it out than replace it because turmeric doesn't taste anything like saffron.
No, and neither does paprika.
Yeah. There's a lot of counterfeited saffron out there with different colored fillers.
And that's what I'm kind of thinking when you say when you go to a restaurant, they have these imitations, risottos, and I agree with you. I've seen it done in restaurants that I've worked in where they make it to order with an instant arborio rice and a powdered mixture. They make it right in the saute pan that they add to it, and it takes only a few minutes, and it doesn't taste the same.
So the point is, if you've had a dish called risotto and you weren't impressed, I don't think it was the real thing.
Right. And what's nice about risotto is when it's left over, it also makes other great dishes. Again, we talked last week about balls. This week, we'll talk about the risotto balls.
Oh, yeah.
Where you can veganize them now, but they are, you take leftover risotto, better if it's a day old, in the refrigerator, of course, and then you add some nutritional yeast or Parmesan substitute, and you take a square of the vegan mozzarella that's out now, which is really great. You put that in the middle of two halves of risotto, and you roll it into like a ball, and then you roll it in breadcrumbs, and you fry it in olive oil, and it melts the cheese inside, and they're fantastic.
You've made them.
Arancina balls.
You've made vegan
versions of
that. So good.
Yeah, it's really good.
Well, what's interesting about risotto and saffron is the history. Now, I wasn't there, but apparently the first risotto recipe dates back to 1809.
Wow.
And the chef put saffron in it for color because they used saffron as a pigment, but they wanted that color for a celebratory wedding feast. And now we've learned, I think they knew it back then too, in different places, even before 1809, because saffron's been consumed in parts of the world for a long, long time. But there's a lot of therapeutic value to saffron. And I'm kind of tempted to make us a saffron tea.
Yeah. Well, what's really fun to do, and we've done it before, we've actually served it at a dinner party, is we have some of that saffron-infused broth, and we've added little tiny, again, balls of risotto to the broth, and we serve it as a soup, and it's delicious.
That you have to make again.
Yes. We actually served it
tomorrow.
The famous Gene Stone.
Yes.
When he was here for dinner.
That's true. When Gene Stone,
when
everybody?
We could have
He's been on
parties.
This program.
You know, and the famous Fran Costigan has been here for many a cocktail party when we were allowed to do those things. She reminded me of something on her Instagram page that I'm kind of in mourning about that I forgot. That Sunday, the 24th of January, was National Peanut Butter Day. And I don't think I participated.
I was all ready to really tear up. We miss National Peanut Butter Day.
National Peanut Butter Day.
Oh, almost every day is Peanut Butter Day.
But when it's National Peanut Butter Day, you know, the whole day has to be made up, for me at any rate, of dishes that have peanuts in them. So I have to make up for it. I think National Peanut Butter Day, as Fran said on her Instagram post, which was mea culpa in because she forgot about it as well. She posted this yesterday. Should last at least 2 days. And I have to say it should last at least 3 days. So
I want to say something about peanut butter. I've told you this, Gary, recently. I review a lot of programs.
Right.
And I was reviewing one webinar recently where one of the speakers said that peanuts and peanut butter are probably the worst things that you can eat.
That's kind of why I brought this up, so you can talk about it.
And unless you're allergic, that's not a true statement.
No.
I will admit there are some people that caution about eating too much peanut butter because it is a high-fat food. But it's a very nourishing food. And I think about President Jimmy Carter.
Right.
I'm sure he's eaten a lot of peanuts in his
Absolutely.
Day.
He will even tell you. Of course, I haven't spoken to the wonderful man, but I've heard him on interview programs. And he will tell you that his family lived on peanuts for a while.
Mm-hmm.
Because they were obviously very poor.
And he is living a very long time, and I hope he lives a lot longer.
Well, I like peanut butter, and I'm sure, as with all nuts, and here's something that is also on my list to talk about today with our fabulous listening audience out there on PRN. Nuts are getting a bad rap by a lot of plant-based people. They say that nuts are bad, and you shouldn't eat that many nuts, and you should really watch
how much fat you consume.
How much fat you consume. I know you're the expert, and I'm sending this out to you. What do you think about that?
Well, first, you know that peanuts are legumes, even though we put them in the nuts category because they have so much fat. I think they're all healthy. I don't think we want to eat a big bowl of any of them. And I know personally, when I eat more than a handful of peanuts, I start to feel that heavy feeling. And I think it's hard for me to digest more than that. And we're all individuals. We all handle food differently. But I personally think fat from whole food sources is nutritious and important. Avocado, raw nuts and seeds. There's plenty of science out there that shows that raw nuts and seeds and peanuts can be part of a nutritious diet. And some people caution that if you're not getting enough fat in your diet, you can have some problems. Now, I'm not talking about a high-fat, animal-based, keto kind of diet.
We're not talking about
this is, you know, an ounce or two of nuts and seeds a day, and that doesn't include your dose of flax seeds or chia seeds, which you need for omega-3 fatty acids. But I think fat is good. We're going to have to wrap this up already.
Already?
Already.
Wow. Fantastic. This was a lot of fun.
It was. And I wanted to mention a couple of things. We were talking about saffron, and I couldn't help but mention Jonathan Safran Foer.
Yes.
Even though he doesn't spell his name the same way.
That's great. Good segue.
But I just want to remind people, and I'm going to link it on this show. He put out an article back in May of 2020. Now, of course, you may know him as the author of a number of fiction books and movies that were made from his fiction books. And then I had him on the program a couple of times talking about his book, Eating Animals and We Are the Weather.
Great books.
And he has an article that I think is really important to talk about called The End of Meat is Here. If you care about the working poor, about racial justice, and about climate change, you have to stop eating animals. So although this article came out in May of last year, and I may have even have talked about it when it came out, I think it's worth bringing up again, not just because his middle name is Safran, and we're talking about saffron, even though they're spelled differently. Jess, there's a lot of important points in that article that I wanted to refer you to.
That's why you're an award-winning radio talk show host, Karen, because you find the saffron in saffron.
Something like that.
Jonathan Safran Foer. I think you should also post your interviews with him because they're really great.
I will.
Yes. Well, I had a great time today. I hope you did.
I did. I just want you to know, Gary, that I am expecting some risotto.
You're expecting?
Very soon.
What? Really? When? Hey, everybody, we're expecting.
We're expecting risotto.
Oh, we're expecting risotto. Is that what we're going to name? What we're expecting?
What we're expecting.
All right.
Risotto,
no, I'm kidding. Yes.
Saffron.
We're going to talk about all of the saffron dishes that we will make next week after I celebrate National Peanut Butter Day with some peanut butter and chocolate chips.
That sounds really good.
And we
That's
have,
for dessert tomorrow.
We have some
after risotto.
Right. We have some of those.
Awesome. Thanks, Gary.
Thanks, Karen.
Hey, everybody.
Have a delicious week.